That's how we landed starting the 11th, but to accommodate that so that we are part of that. We are welcoming the department led by the DC to make our first decision on the exams. I hope as a comment on that, we have something to share about our grade 11. There's this current issue about grade 11 out there. Shall I hand over to the
Thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Committee, and now from the Department to also convey our best wishes to this Committee. For what others are, I think, regard as the new year, although we were saying education, the year starts much, much earlier. In fact, our year starts on the 29th of December, and it feels quite old already, I think, for some of us. But greetings certainly, and I'm sure we have an exciting year ahead. Chair, although you say it's not our responsibility, I apologize that you weren't able to get into the media briefing. We can certainly avail you with the media statement that was delivered there, but it is regrettable because I think a lot of issues that were just dealt with through questions, etc., would have been extremely important for this committee to be part of. So I would encourage yourself, perhaps as chair, to pick it up with GCI and see what the understanding is. I presume the honourable members who did attend will, in fact, own up to that and perhaps explain how they were able to get in there, and not yourself as chair, but that's your internal discipline, chair. Current chair, we have indicated some areas that we would like to propose to the committee for presentation during the course of this year, and I do understand that there is a process for that, and we look forward to engaging in that. We also, of course, would indicate that there is definitely some legislation the Minister is preparing. One will be an Education Laws Amendment Bill with a variety of different issues, but those in the media briefing this morning would also have heard that by July this year, the Minister is keen to have concluded the NQF review process, and that itself could lead to a wide-ranging set of legal legislative amendments. So the committee may well be fully engaged in those as well for a large part of the year. But for today, Chair, I think, given your guidance, we've agreed that we should pick up on the starting point, which was an assessment of last year. And although it's not a perfect indicator, one of the key factors is the matric exams themselves. And we would like to then present to you both the results of the matric exams and some of the details that we can pull out of that. And then perhaps to reflect a bit following from that on the learner attainment strategies, our strategies for improvement in the system that are ongoing. I'm accompanied by my Deputy Director General, Ms. Kenny Vignopolt, the DDG for Further Education and Training, and Ms. Ingwebeni is the director in my office. But if I can share through you, then ask Ms. Vignopolt to do the presentation. I believe the electronics are not working yet, so we're working on hard copy, if that's acceptable. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Gigi. Good morning, honourable members. It's good to see you again. Chairman, I'm going to start with an analysis of the examination results and the learner attainment strategy. And I think that because members are very aware of the results, they were much publicised in the press of last year, I'd really like to take this opportunity to give a much deeper analysis of the results and to ask members advice on what they think they can do, what we should do to improve our results and our strategy. In a sentence, we can say that in terms of access, more young people pass the senior certificate exam on a more cognitively demanding set of papers. This is the first national examination. 85% of our learners wrote national papers. Compared to racially divided department papers of the period prior to 1995, and then from 1995 to 2002, provincially divided papers. But we're still concerned about the quality as it reflected in the endorsements and the higher grade papers. But to get to the more sophisticated analysis, it's important that we look at the schooling realities, 12 million children in school, that we continue the South African education system in comparison to other middle income countries to retain our people in the public system. And that's a real vote of confidence where people don't have choice. You'll see only 2% of learners in independent schools. Our 340,000 teachers and 26,000 schools. It's important that in the third slide that we want to make the point is that we would also like members to help us with this, but you know, national pass rates don't tell us all the useful information we need on the goals set by government. And those goals are access, keeping learners in the system, especially those who were previously excluded, improved quality, because we know increasingly the senior certificate doesn't lead to employment as it did in the past, so we're looking for quality, and the moment that is the proxy is the endorsement rate and high grade subjects, and then our gateway subjects, again, crucial to ASGEITA, and dealing with underperformance. So what we want to present today is focus on access, quality, maths and science, and dealing with underperformance. The start of 2006 was quite special. It started schooling in 1995. It had 12 years of schooling in a democratic, non-racial, single South African system. And as I said earlier, the quality of the examinations was more demanding by all independent judges. And mostly because we didn't have the unevenness of provincial exams that we now have 11 subjects being written. But Chair, that does mean that the system is going to shake. We thought there'd be much more of a shudder because the exams are uneven. But in fact, we saw in some provinces a bit of a wobble. But in fact, we believe we're now onto a national high-quality examination. Despite the increase in the quality, you can see since 2002, increasing numbers writing the senior certificate exam and also passing. Go to page 2 then. And again, Chair, what this means as we move to a national system, and the Minister spoke about this morning, is it's important for members to understand the magnitude of the enterprise, of what goes in to running a huge exam like this, and then to argue that the irregularities that get reported are a tiny, tiny minority of what can happen on a daily basis. there the numbers are growing, the number of exam centers, you'll see that there are more exam centers than there are schools. And the reason for that is because we allow young and old people to write in prison. We have quite a few prison centers. We have a number of adult centers. Because last year, 190,000 young and older people wrote as private candidates. They wrote part-time, they wrote two or three subjects. That explains why we've got more exam centers than schools. And then our provinces have marking centers. Again, one thing that won't change with the move to a national examination is that we will continue to mark at a provincial and district level. Part of this is because it's such a powerful tool for professional development. As a teacher myself, I remember going and mark my first set of exams, and it really is a powerful indication of what standards are expected and how a national department is approaching the setting and marking of papers. And you will see that there's close to 30,000 teachers an opportunity to mark. The quality of the exam papers, what we do is that, as I said, the 11 we set nationally, and for the first time here we've moved from a single examiner to a panel of examiners. Again, we do draw from our public school system and from our subject advisors. We're also drawing in more HUR people, but not to dominate our panel, but also to give us a sense of what higher education is looking for. And really the instruction to the examiners is now to start to improve the quality of the papers, including the cognitive demand, because clearly all indications are that we're falling a little bit behind, not our top students, but that we need to make sure that our papers are of excellent quality. The slide on the left, the bottom of page 2, just looks at this very long process, just to remind members that we've already started preparing for 2008, resetting the examinations. This is really an 18-month cycle of setting the exams, because then they have to be moderated, they have to be translated, we have to register, distribute, mark, and standardize. So two things that we were quite proud of is that the independent bodies of HESA and Uluruti, our quality assurance body, certainly gave strong thumbs up to the examination. And HESA, you'll see we've replicated here part of their statement about the strides made in the integrity of the exam, how we closed up the opportunities to cheat or for papers to leak, and then also the evidence that there's improved quality and language, but asking us to provide more evidence. And that's something we should have asked our examiners and moderators to do. When it comes to the standardization, when it comes to press releases, we can rely on written statements of the cognitive demands of the exam. Well, Lucy also noted improved administrative systems. That means that the exams were run well. If you think that they were not only the 528, but the 190 runs in the order of 700,000 papers being distributed and marked, the administrative systems that improved despite the increase in quantity is something we're proud of. They also noted improvement in the quality of the question papers and the numbers writing and passing the exams. So an important thing for us is to communicate to the public that an irregularity in itself is not a bad thing, but an irregularity that's not reported or that's not dealt with is a bad thing. Everybody across the world, whether you've been in Britain or Malawi, children cheat, parents, teachers try to cheat because obviously these are high-stakes exams. The important thing is to deal with them, and we now have a national irregularity committee that looks and makes sure that the same punishment is dealt to the same kind of offences. And here the punishments are severe. If you get caught cheating in any kind of way, taking notes in, teachers writing on the board, you're banned from writing the senior certificate for 2 years. So, and of course, it's disciplinary action taken against teachers that get involved. So I think that we've really got the punishments clear now. It's now making sure that all our schools, our provinces, and we saw that this past year, submit any concerns about it. It doesn't matter how small it is, we take it seriously and we investigate. Uluruti also looked at the cognitive demand. It is Uluruti that challenged us 2 years ago to increase the cognitive demand of our papers. And you've got the declaration at the bottom of page 2. So let's go onto the results. I want to start on the left-hand side of the bottom of page 4. And what you see there is the results from 2001 through to 2006. And let's start right at the bottom with the national figures. And you will see that really quite a spectacular increase in numbers passing from 277 to 351. So in order of 80,000 more than 80,000 more passing over more cognitively. Now that is something to be celebrated in the system. If we look across the provinces, there were only two provinces where there was a decline, and that is in KwaZulu-Natal from 84 down to 82, but still the 82,000 is way above the 58,000 of 2001. The other state was in Limpopo, where we saw from between 2005 and 2006 a 1,200 decline from the 60,000 of 2005 to the 58,850 of 2006. But again, 10,000 more than in 2001. And again, to make the point that for the first time these are national papers, they're not as predictable and they are more difficult. And so I think that in all cases, the provinces need to be congratulated. Drawing attention particularly to the Eastern Cape and Free State, where we see 1,000 to 2,000 more learners passing despite the increase in quality. If we look at the gender, there's always been a concern in the little graph. You see that it's not only the number of male passes that has increased, the males are at the top, the female at the bottom in the graph. But if you go over, you can see the two tables show that gap between male and female passes is declining. In 2001, there was a 3.5% differential. And you'll see as you go down the graph, the table, it goes down to 2.4. So we're narrowing the gap between male and female participation and passes. And then the graph below the table shows how close that's becoming. In 1996, the gap was 8.2% differential between male and female, and it was down to 2.4 in 2006. So then, if we look at the districts, and this is becoming a very important thing that we'd like members to take up again in their visits, is to start looking at the performance of the district. The district is the closest management center, the unit of management closest to the schools. And if you look, let's look at the Eastern Cape, you will see that there were 24 districts in the Eastern Cape in 2005. It's been reduced to 23 because of the movement of the new demarcation of the boundaries. So that's the explanation. It's lost 19 high schools, many more primary schools to KwaZulu-Natal. And you will see that in Eastern Cape, the number of districts with below 50% pass has declined from 6 districts in 2005 down to 3. So that's a big improvement, and you can see in the 51 to 60% the shift that goes from 10 to 7, also down. And then what's very good is to see that in 61 to 70, that's where the majority of districts are now sitting in 2006. That movement away from the under 50 and under 60, in fact, into the 60 to 70. But if we look at the very last two rows, 81 to 100,000, that's where we want all our districts to be. And you will see that only Gauteng and Western Cape have got districts that fall inside those lines. But that's our goal. When we talk about the National Learner Attainment Strategy, that's where we're wanting to shift all our districts to have schools performing between 81 and 100,000. So I'm not going to go through the detailed strategy. It's been left in for members to monitor. You can monitor over the next 2 years, because we really are making the National Learner Attainment Strategy a published document so that that members can track our performance. But the important thing is that it's a 3-year, it focuses on the school, the teacher, and the learner. So it tries in an integrated way to look at all three, and it also doesn't just look at grade 12. It's very important with grade 10 and 11. And when we talk later about our grade 10 and 11 classes, everything that we, the department and the minister said, is to make sure that our young people get a quality education, that isn't compromised. So then if we look at the subject results on page 6, you will see the physical science. Still many more on the standard grades than on the high grades. We've seen both in maths and science very nice increases from 2002, 70,000 to 81,000 in 2006 on the standard grade, very slight increase in high grades, and that's where we really saw the lady and all other initiatives we wanted to target increases in that. You'll see even a slight decline in 2006. Again, more cognitively demanding papers, but I think now that we've set the standard, we really hope that we're going to start moving that number up. And to just remind you that our target is 50,000 by 2008. On page 7, we've got the maths results. Similar situation, but a nice increase from 2002, but in both the high grade and standard grade, a slight dip in 2006. Under the maths, there are the performance on all the new national exam papers. What we've listed there for members is the numbers passing, the numbers failing on the big papers that we set. You see Afrikaans, agriculture, business economics, economics, and geography. Those in addition to maths and science are the subjects that we examine. So then to finish off on the national strategy for learning attainment, you know, we started this minister that launched this in 2004, but again, within the provinces, it took on different forms and formats. What we've done this year is that we've had a 4-day board ride with all the provinces to make sure that that's an overarching and transversal program. We said that it's not going to be located just in grades 10, 11, and 12, but the very foundation of learning starts in the foundation phase, grades 1, 2, and 3. You'll see that much of what the minister announces and what the department focuses on this year will be on the foundation phase, making sure that we get the foundations of reading, writing, and calculating really solid, because that's the beginning of success in grade 12. So we say that the program is now planned and sustained. It's not once-off and cosmetic. And again, what we will provide to members in March when we presented it to HEDCOM is the actual details of each provincial strategy. They call different things. Some call it a learner performance strategy, others call it different things. But what we've got all the provinces to agree to is that the goals are the same, and we've worked out what works and what doesn't, and that you will be able to monitor when you visit schools exactly what provinces are doing to make sure that the strategy is being implemented. On page 8, you'll see the legs that it's based on. I spoke about we're not just focusing on learners, we're looking at schools, teachers, and learner attainment. So there's three legs to the strategy. And also in the slide to the left of the tree with the three legs, you've got the imperatives to raise learner achievement right from grades R to grade 12. But our initial focus is on the foundations, grades 1, 2, and 3, and grades 10, 11, and 12. We need to employ different strategies and approaches and move beyond the narrow constraints of only the academic and theory. We're looking at an overall holistic approach to learner development. The national strategy then, we set out there the 7 points of the strategy. Overall performance across all schools, increased number of learning classrooms with endorsement of quality, and schools performing below the national. The one on the left is school development, and then the middle leg is teacher development and learner attainment. I mean, our experience and experience of other countries is that you can't, you know, we tended to focus on school management. But we know now that we need to develop our teachers as well, as well as to encourage our learners to spend more time, time is eroded in our schools, to spend more time learning, and to enroll for the higher grade subjects. People are speaking a lot of fear of these, and I think that we want to spend a lot of time saying how important it is that your learning and earning opportunities are opened up rather than closed down by spending a lot more time learning. So, you know, we have to also focus on making sure learners have got a textbooks in front of them and that they really spend time learning. Okay, so the little diagram is just to say that it is a three-pronged strategy and that we can't deal with schools in isolation. Then just to go back to the slide, it's schools, we're also looking at schools performing below the national average. You know, we have moved to very low numbers under 20% now. While we'll still deal with the 139 under 20%, We want to expand that to looking at all schools under 50% to make sure that we don't have schools sliding back under the 20%. So we've got that. And then giving all learners a chance in the system through our national numeracy and literacy strategy, linking it to the math, science, and language intervention so that they are not in isolation from our learner attainment strategy, and making sure that we eliminate the 20% performance in each province. Also, other targets of increased endorsements in schools, so that schools don't think that they've reached the pinnacle of success when they get 100% pass. Many of those schools with 100% pass have no endorsements or very few, and shouldn't be seen as success. Their next target is to increase the number of endorsements, and also to get more historically disadvantaged learners into the top 50 in each province. We're starting to see that very nice shift, but again, it's a target. The minister gave the ICIC is our interprovincial examining committee, and they're the committee that is tasked with developing the national learner attainment strategy. And we've set out their remit to the reporter. Chair, at the bottom of the page, you just see again, we need to rework through the provinces, the provincial improvement plan. Provinces work through their districts and schools. So again, in your monitoring visits, you can look at that cycle to make sure that the provincial plan is being communicated to the districts and the districts are communicating to the schools. Because in some cases, we found that we thought we'd done our job in our communication to the provinces, but when we visit schools, we find that their strategies haven't been communicated to all schools. And so we really want to deepen the understanding of what these strategies are, and it will help us if we monitor that issue. So then just finally, on the NSOA, we a lot of this is repeated, what we're doing about teachers, focusing on the ITMS. Again, to say that we try to make sure that all our strategies, we incorporate them into this, that it's not ad hoc strategies, and then you'll recognize the 3-year teacher development program, our new teacher development framework will inform the way we approach the teacher development and reporting. Also, international experience shows that parental involvement is very important, even if parents are illiterate, making sure that they check homework, that they follow their learners' progress, that they attend meetings at the school, that they really hold the schools accountable for learning, for making sure that time is spent teaching. And then the learner achievement, that's the last leg of it under after teacher development, is looking at grade 1 to 12 with a focus on 10 to 12. Just to share the last two bullets, they are very important. The time and time spent teaching and learning, we think, is extremely important. In the schools that have, especially poor schools that have very good results, we see that the time is sacred. It is kept sacred. Nothing is allowed to interfere with it. They teach for the 190 to 200 days of the year, and they teach the 5 hours a day. So it's so obvious, but I think that we haven't stressed that enough. And then also access to textbooks. And then complete monitor those for us to report where they experience a lack of textbooks or that they feel the time is being eroded. Because if you look at the bullet above that, the focus on targeted intervention, well, interesting enough, some of our visits to our Dilaneli school, teachers who are new to South Africa commented on the fact that children seem to think that if they go to a Saturday school or they go to a special intervention, then they'll pass higher grade math. But then they don't come to school, and they don't do their homework. And their point was is that getting higher grade math is a systematic, long-term, many-hour-long project, and that you can easily finish the curriculum if you stick to the school days and hours. And the school I'm talking about, that's the thing in Northwest, where we particularly found it. They had 25 more kids pass in high grade just on that single intervention. No Saturday schools, no holiday classes, but just making sure the time was kept sacred, and they were one of our most improved schools. So can we go then to page 10 just to look at the schools with the pass rate below 20%? I think that you'll see from 1999 a very nice decline from 1,034 schools under 20% in 2006 139. We'd like to eliminate those this year. But the important thing to note amongst those 139 is that only 14 of them were there last year. The others have moved up, but then clearly another 110 odd have slipped back in. And so it's making sure if you see in the slide below that, looking at all our schools below 50% and making sure that we pass them. The unfortunate thing is to see that we have had 119 odd schools have slipped into the under 50% pass rate, partly because of the more difficult exams, but again, evidence that not enough time was spent teaching. And so we face a huge challenge, especially in some provinces, of looking at the under 50%. Toka 1,700, but if you look at the Western Cape, there are only 16, Northern Cape only 8, and Free State only 36. We've challenged those provinces to say they now need to look at a few more schools that are under 60% and start moving up. So every province has got its targets. Clearly Limpopo and KwaZulu-Natal will have their hands full with those large number of schools under 50%. But those two provinces in Eastern Cape will be where the national department will be providing particular support to the subject advisors, providing training to the subject advisors. In other words, those people in the districts who will be expected to support the schools. So on page 11, we see a very big the success story of last year. There were, of the 138 schools under 20% in 2006, 114 were public schools, the rest were private schools. So we only deal with the public schools. And of the 114 public schools, 99% improved. They came out of that, so 99 schools improved, came out of that category. The little pie chart below that shows that 15 of them stayed under 20%, but that 49 went into the 20 to 40%, 35 went to 41 to 60%, 18 to the 61 to 79%, and 7 incredibly went right up to 60%. Now, some cases it was a reduced number passing, but in other cases they maintained the numbers writing and still passed. So I think that shows the success of vigilance, of watching, of an external body. In some cases this is the MEC, in some cases provinces paying particular attention to the school. So we can show we can do it, but we've got to now expand that vigilance to all the schools under 50%. We probably won't have such a success rate, but I think it's interesting to see what happens when we focus our attention on these schools. So the very last part, just for members noting and for information, you've seen it all in these books. We just put out there the trends on the numbers passing, the numbers of endorsements, and the numbers passing. 2000, page 12, you've just got all the stats you need on the 2006 results. But I think it's important that we keep a global picture to keep up the trends to see whether we've improved or not. In summary, then, to say that we're pleased with the improvements in the numbers in rolling, writing, and passing, but much more has to be done about the quality and the gateway subject.
Thank you ever so much. I'm not sure how much more you have in your team, but I know with this position, while they start debating, you're going to take an hour doing that. I have something on Lena Support, I suppose. Are you sharing something on that today?
On Lena Support?
Yes. You're not sharing anything on that today?
No, the learner training strategy is what we call our learner support. So that strategy, I can go back to those slides if you want to. The
strategy for learner support, unless you mean learner support materials, textbooks.
Oh, maybe my victim got it wrong. I'm having a learner support material of mine. No problem. It's a different understanding.
Okay.
No problem. It's just like that. I think what we need to do, I think we go back now for questions and answers and comments. Maybe the best thing is to, if possible, we start from the first page, we follow it through. I think that is the broader. And I think informally, maybe members could also be sharing their own experiences. Remember, we took our first 2 weeks to these schools as a committee, and we need to bring those together into one report. I hope members could do that. And so that we try, because I think the department does want our assistance as far as monitoring is concerned. let me call this General Observation from the Eastern Cape, the Transkei in particular. When you read the high school there, the Transkei has an anomaly. I don't know whether it is true that that anomaly is peculiar there. While in the rest of South Africa, when you talk about the high school, or senior secondary school, it's grade 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. When you go to the Transkei, most different courses in senior secondary schools are grades 10, 11, 12. Which means a principal in a given school has only 3 years to catch up. And this becomes worse. Maybe let me tell you if I get another question. I don't know whether the department has looked at it. When we consider our grade 12 examinations and even talk about dysfunctional schools, that is determined by the department. But for some reason, I ask my researchers that work at the department know something about it. Some of us, we had certificates for them at 6, certificate for JC and certificate for standard care. Now, currently, we did away with all those national certificates. It's only the last one, grade 12. Now, when you go to read those schools, again, if you talk about even our international rating, the quality of our education, when you use that international scale, you find that one lower down there. What end up wondering is one of the reasons of that, not because down there in our secondary schools, Nepal schools have a number of dysfunctional schools, but we have no way yet to find out. You visit school, for example, you talk about this MCS, we just talk about documentation. Depending on what you're talking about, they receive the document, they find it, they don't know what you're talking about. But unfortunately, we have no formula system, and I think when it's constant talk about the energy, one of the biggest frustrations in those schools, and that teachers come late, some teachers go home early, teachers, if it is the end of the year, it's on a Wednesday, and there's a general assembly, that no teachers will come, someone come. If we are as far as going to school, that is not happening. Which is very important. Unfortunately, our SGBs do not have that feel that it is their responsibility to see to that has to happen. As I shared, for example, with everybody, when the schools are closed because there was a meeting, a certain meeting, nobody was bothered. It is one of those things that happen normally. So basically, I'm throwing two main questions. One, the Transkei question. I don't know whether the department has looked at that, it is something that has not been taken into on board because it could have an effect on their lives. The secondly, the way the possibility of considering reinstating, I know that could be a very expensive exercise, but what do I know? I would like to know what is happening in other countries. Are they having one educational examination? And could this not be one of the factors that our teachers in our secondary schools, in our primary schools, that our kids can go up to grade 8, 7, not being able to write and read, is because they are not looking for any national level. They just sit there, teach chapter 3, pass it end of year.
Yes, if I may, I think you've given us a lot to test to respond to, and if you just try and pick up on some. Your first point around the former Transkei, I think it is, categorization of schools, this is an issue that's been plaguing us for a while, and we've certainly tried to make an assessment of the situation, but I have to be honest that every time we try to determine a particular model that this will be a primary school and this will be a secondary school, we're always faced with all sorts of particular contexts where that situation doesn't work. Either it's the availability of classroom spaces that limits that particular school to just 3 grades, 10, 11, 12, or a combination of combined school types, etc. So it's been very difficult for us to try and impose a particular model and organization of schools on the system, particularly, as I say, given the complexity, I think, of where we are. So I would probably have to take that as a comment and probably advice from you that we should go back to the issue and see whether we can't bring about a bit more order. But I would also be cautious. There's nothing inherent in saying that because you've only got 10, 11, 12, therefore you should do worse in matric. It depends, as you acknowledge, that on the quality of preparation for children before that. But certainly, if you have a good primary school, you have a good combined school that takes them up to grade 9, there's nothing that would then limit those learners in the grade 10, 11, 12 context to also do well in matric. So that we would have to take into account, but we will certainly relook at it. Chair, the issue of your question of certification prior to grade 12 is one. You'll recall, of course, we had made a commitment to introduce a general education training certificate, the GETC, at the end of grade 9. We've wavered on this for a while. Part of it certainly is the cost factor. Early estimates suggested some 300 million rand we would have to spend if we were going to administer an external exam and certificate at the level of GETC. And yet the evidence is, of course, that 99% of children, particularly in this day and age, Chair, are not leaving school at that stage. They're in fact just going up to grade 10 in the same school, up to the next grade in the same school, and therefore the idea of an external exam to get you from grade 9 to grade 10, just and certainly a very expensive exam, really didn't seem to make any sense at all. So that was the one limitation. But probably more importantly for us was also a sense of building standards towards the GTC. To introduce that sort of examination, we need to be sure that learners, teachers, schools are prepared for it, so that we don't just put everyone into a situation which produces a disaster. Now, you'll know that over the past 5-6 years now, we've been running what we call the Common Tasks for Assessment, CTAs. I know they've caused some discomfort, and we've refined and I think revised them down to a much more acceptable approach now. But those CTAs are in fact administered now in every single grade 9 class across the country. Every school has to administer the CTAs, which are nationally set examinations, tests, tasks, etc., at the level of grade 9. And really the point of those, I think, is to start building expectations among teachers, learners and schools about what in fact is expected at the end of grade 9. So that when we do come to a GETC, and the Minister has indicated she wishes to move to that in the next year or two, that we do already then have an understanding of what that GETC will look like, what sort of standards it will be setting, etc., so that it does become hopefully a useful instrument. I also remind you, Chair, of course, that we are now on a regular basis doing the systemic evaluation at both grade 3 and grade 6 levels. We did grade 3 a number of years ago, we did grade 6 last year, we're going to do grade 3 again during the course of this year. These are tests of about some 30,000-35,000 learners, randomly chosen, but again I think the value is that what we've done is we've now distributed those tests, those systemic evaluation assessments, we've distributed those to all schools. So even if you weren't part of that 30,000 sample that we drew, every grade 3 teacher now has a copy of those tests. They know that if we do come to you this year and say, now you're going to be part of it, they know what their grade 3s and grade 6s are going to be expected to do. We're starting in that way also, I think, to build that understanding around standards, etc., and certainly that is making a difference. I think also one of the important elements of this is that what we've done is following an analysis of the results of those grade 3 and grade 6 evaluations, we've then provided feedback to the teachers in the term of booklets that have really said now in your school learners did well in these areas, however they didn't do so well in the following areas, and here's some guidance, here's some advice, here's some materials, here's some lesson plans, etc., which you can use to pick up on these. So we're seeing this is not just as a testing and leave it, it's a testing and remediation, retest, remediation, and in that way hopefully get better and better. So I think, Chair, we are starting to, as you say, through the system rather than just at the final stage,
starting to get a sense of that quality, and I have to say already is starting to show the evidence of which schools, even at the primary level, are working and which are not. Just one little point, Chair. You know, it's often said that we as a country don't perform as well as many other countries, including some countries that are poorer than us, and on the surface that appears true. Chair, the one question that you always need to ask when you look at that sort of data is what percentage of learners are making it through to that level where it's been tested. Most of that sort of testing is done at the secondary school level, equivalent to grade 10, 11, 12 perhaps. And what you'll find is in many of those countries, which yes, do get a higher pass rate when they tested on these international studies, but in fact, they've had a very small proportion of their learners, in fact, move from the primary up into the secondary phase. In a sense, they've already selected their top students to go into secondary schooling, and those are the ones who then get tested in these international studies. Our difference is that some 85% of our learners are now going through to matric, including your good, including some bad, and therefore we don't overall perhaps do as well as some other countries would, but Penny put it rightly, our emphasis is a dual one. One is on access, getting as many learners as possible through the system. The second is the quality, making sure they do as well as possible. Some other countries have put a lot more emphasis on quality and are prepared to abandon learners and the imperative for access in order to get that so-called quality. So there is a point there. Chair, just a final one then on the causes perhaps of underperformance. And you picked on teachers, and certainly there is a concern there. But let's also recognise, Chair, that when we monitor schools at the opening of schools, it's fascinating. You go to some schools, Minister went to one in your province, Eastern Cape, got there at 10 to 8 in the morning, just outside Port Elizabeth, principal still wasn't there. Minister twiddled her thumbs for a bit, and then at 5 to 8 the principal arrived, and she said to him, "Well, you're a bit late, aren't you?" And he said, no, school only starts at 8. So legally he was there on time, but you have to say that the principal on the first day of school, most of them are there long before that, yeah, and that was the point she was making. And the truth is, many of the schools we do visit, and we say to them, "Yeah, how's the first day of school gone?" And they said, no, this wasn't the first day of school. We actually started last week. We came in last week. Learning even started last week. We need to recognize an enormous number of schools are now moving into morning classes, afternoon classes, Saturday classes, holiday classes. I think this message about time on task is really something that's getting through. You will see those schools that are performing are not just using, obviously, the 7 hours of the school day, but are going well beyond that, and we certainly need to give recognition to those teachers, but as you say, there are many, and it is an ongoing problem, who unfortunately are not playing that role. Your point about the SGBs, I think, is very important. The Minister has asked us to look in the Education Laws Amendment Bill, or whatever other instruments we need, is how we emphasise the role of the SGB in regard to educational quality. We put a lot of emphasis up from now on the governance of the school, the financial management, the infrastructure, all of those kind of things. We haven't specified that the actual primary role of the SGB is to make sure there's quality education in the school, and whatever it needs, they must do that. So we will certainly be doing that, but in the end, Chair, that's a fairly long-term process. It's about building expectation about what we expect of schools. The truth is, many of our parents who sit on governing bodies themselves attended schools which knocked off at 11 o'clock on a Friday. So as you say, when teachers go, I see that's the problem. That's how schools work. What we have to do is change that understanding of what a good school is. And let me assure you, there are many, many schools who now have that understanding. And I promise you, you can go there 5, 6 in the afternoon, you will still find the teachers there, you will find the learners there, you will find the SGBs supporting them there. And I think the Minister's message this morning, and I'm sorry but if you missed it, is what we're looking at now is while we do focus on the underperforming schools and work with them, one of the things we don't always do well in this country is to acknowledge and reward success. Where schools do well, we must recognise it, build on it, expand it, but that perhaps will also be part of getting that message through about what it is we expect of schools. So let me pause for a moment, Chair, and see if there's anything else.
I hope everybody knows what
SGB
stands for.
Mm-hmm.
It's and what is our CGE. Sometimes we throw this. Very new something. Can you just explain that, especially the GGC one?
Yeah. The GGC is your General Education and Training Certificate. Technically, the matric exam is a further education and training certificate. On the NQF, it is registered as an FETC at grade 12. 3 years below that, you have your GETC, your general education training certificate, at grade 9. It's also, by the way, a generic certificate, for example, your ABET learners who do the 4 years of ABET. They qualify with the GETC, so it's a universal qualification. The CTAs, Chair, are your common tasks for assessment. They are a set of tasks that we develop at a national level. As I say, are given to all schools, and all schools administer those tasks, so they can also judge their learners in terms of the national performance in some way. Thank you, Chair. Sorry about that.
No problem. I think on the side of consequence, you know, for continued failure, they are not happening with our friends, as far as that is concerned. If I can start by saying that pertaining to these underperforming schools, and especially those who are on the pass rates below 20%, it seems that we have reached a ceiling there since 2003. And you know, even if a school improves its rate, that is now phase 10, but I'm referring to the average performance of the schools that is mentioned. I don't know whether our strategies are really working as far as those schools are concerned, and maybe this is an area where we must look at how we deal with schools that continue to perform and not well at all. There are certain mechanisms in place, but I don't think they're really used. For instance, mentor and curator principles and so on. Maybe the DG or the Deputy Director General can assist us in saying, in telling us whether there is a new plan to deal with the continuing underperformance of some of these schools. As I say, even schools that improve their rating from 20% to 30%, I think that's just not good enough. And I think, Chair, that while one can congratulate the department, especially with regard, for instance, to the quality and standard of the matric exam that we had, I think that was a very good achievement, and the comments of independent commentators indicated also that indeed that level, it still seems that with regard to the question of maths and science higher grade pass, and with regard to the whole issue of endorsement, we are not really making progress. We have strategies in place, we have the Inaleri strategy and others in place, but it still seems that we just can't get through a ceiling. Are there new plans, are there new strategies that you have in mind to deal with this matter? Because I think that, you know, if we improve the number of passes, access and so on, all those matters are very important. But in terms of the quality of our passes, it seems that we are not really making headway. The same goes for the literacy and numeracy levels that are also seemingly not really improving enough. So my question in that regard is, are we saying that our current strategies are not really working, that we have to develop a new strategy? Are there new plans to deal with this? Does it have to do something with teacher training that is not adequate? What are the real problems? How are we going to solve it to get to this situation?
Yes, very much. Thank you, Prof, and everybody present here. Indeed, Honorable Government needs to continue to come up with a strategy. We do have a very serious problem regarding the issue results in this country. And our problem is, as Prof has alluded to, we, most of the time when talking about bad or good results, refer to matric results, which is the final exam. We which is the final exam of school. Now, we seem to actually forget that we need to build a very firm foundation from grade one in order to prepare learners right through from grade one up to matric to pass and pass well, so that with this culture of teaching and learning is not only emphasized at matric level, but from the base, from grade one, and then it must develop that way throughout the schooling process. In that way, we are not going to encounter any headaches about the matric results, because we shall have actually inculcated the culture of learning and commitment to learning in both teachers and learners themselves. And we will have our learners passing with exemption at matric level. The other thing is, we no longer have in our country colleges that produce primary school teachers. We soon closed all the colleges and we created a vacuum. All our teachers that we have are trained at university level, and they don't know how to deal with the beginners, the lower primary kids. And in this way, we are encountering problems in our endeavor to establish firm foundation at the primary level, at the grade one, from grade R upwards. So I want to find out from the department if they don't have any plans to actually begin to find out if they could have colleges that would produce teachers that are meant to deal with children, younger children who are starting schooling, who can actually be able to establish firm foundation at primary level, so that we can no longer have to take people who are trained to teach at high schools and take them to the primary to deal with little children. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me first start by commenting the department DG for the support we saw this morning to the minister at the media briefing. That was a good thing. And also to commend the minister for his response to those questions. And also to say that we were those who managed to attend the protection center. Yeah, the term Sana here says but we managed to be there, unaware that we were not supposed to. But we are saying we were lucky because we managed to get those questions and even to see the media trying to change that meeting to a SAFA meeting, not the election. But they really minister tried to speak to thank you, DG.
Yeah, with regard to the NSLE. And then the minister also requested us to visit schools just to check how many without textbooks. And then S-Prof has already indicated that we visited schools. Now my question is that what can be the short term, maybe short term to address the shortage of textbooks, because one school we visited, we found that four children are to share one textbook. What can be the immediate solution to that? And then the other one was the issue of students who are forced to travel long distance, or maybe to walk long distance to go and look for this science subject, leaving schools at their area, and then that within their areas there are no science subjects. That's my question for now. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, again. Certainly, I will hand over. Let me just clarify, Advocate Graham, says, and just looking at the numbers, that the number under 20% has remained more or less static, that could be a ceiling of some sort. But we do need to recognize, of course, that those aren't necessarily the same schools that are sitting there. As Penny indicated, Mr. Newport, we had 114 schools in that category. 99 of them actually moved out of that category. And most dramatically, 7 of them moved from below 20% to above 80% in 1 year. So I think to suggest that the thing is now static and these schools are stuck there certainly is not indicated by the evidence. Many schools indeed did move up. Some stayed there, but of course the worrying part is some others moved down. But I think, as Ms. Winifox has said, what it did demonstrate is the value of interventions, where these schools got a little bit, and let me be quite clear, these schools did not get extra money or teachers or resources. They basically got more support, they got more attention, they were tightly monitored, etc., and on the basis of that they were able to deliver better results. So there's a very important lesson that we learned there. So certainly we'd never want to, as I say, just say that that's the situation and we now leave it. He asked if there is a new strategy, and certainly I can indicate that I've appointed just last week the former head of department from the Mpumalanga Education Department to head up a task team to work with all these 130 or so underperforming schools. He will be visiting each one of them, and in each case he will be looking at the kind of support that they need. We're very encouraged. We've had a number of offers from various organizations to so-called adopt these schools, including some of our teacher unions and others. And really the task will be to try and coordinate that kind of support so we don't see all 10 organizations now adopting this one school and the one next door doesn't get anyone, so it's about to spread there. But I think, Chair, something we'd want to encourage members here as well to think about. If they want a list of these 150 or so schools, we can provide it to them. I think it would be lovely if each of you just took responsibility for one of them and said, we're going to see what happens with this school. And as I say, it's not about more money, it's about a little bit of attention, support, etc. And I'm sure that this task team headed by Dr. Mashinini will certainly assist in this regard. Chair, the issue of matric and the progress on endorsements that Advocate is raising is, of course, a concern. We do recognize that there hasn't been the progress we like. The question he raises is what is the constraint? And I do believe teachers are a part of the problem, and it's not a criticism of individuals. It's two factors. One, of course, is the quality of their own preparation and concept knowledge. But another, of course, is the distribution. We know that there are schools, regrettably, who offer maths but don't have a qualified maths teacher. By contrast, we have a number of schools where you might have 8 or 9 well-qualified maths teachers all locked up in one school. It's a consequence, of course, of our particular approach to appointments, where schools largely manage that process. But I can signal that the Minister has asked us to relook at this issue and see how we can ensure that every school, every high school, gets at least a qualified maths teacher, given that now maths or maths literacy is indeed a compulsory part of the school program. But, Chair, again to recognise, and this I can hint at Mr. Bonanno's question, as the DDG indicated,
Our focus at this stage is certainly not just on the grade 12 and trying to improve matric by focusing on the teaching and learning at that level. As he says, and I have to agree with him on this one, the essence is to build from those foundations. And we recognize that, we stated it quite clearly. The only disagreement is, he said, from grade 1, we say no, from grade R, in fact. That's where it starts. You would have seen the minister put a lot of emphasis on our literacy and numeracy strategy. Part of that grade 3 and grade 6 evaluation was trying to say, how do we ensure that by the time they hit these standards, they're doing the necessary in terms of being able to read, to write, to count, etc., because in the end, that's going to produce the kind of matrix we want. So certainly we would concur with them on that. I'm less concurrent on the issue of the colleges, and perhaps just a clarification, there is this public image that in fact we closed all the colleges. That's not true. We in fact incorporated these colleges into our universities. If you look at the big colleges like Johannesburg College of Education, that's very much now part of the Wits Faculty of Education. They took over all the human resource capacity that was in that college, and that continues to serve for the training of teachers both for secondary and primary levels. I think if you look at Edgewood College down in KwaZulu-Natal, that is now the centerpiece, in fact, of your education faculty of the University of KwaZulu-Natal. University of Pretoria took over the whole Kundtloo campus of the Normal College. So really to say that the colleges have disappeared, it is wrong. They are still there, but they're part of the universities now, and overall, as I say, with that human resource capacity. That's not to say that there's a denial that historically universities did focus more on secondary training teachers for secondary education, but I do believe all of them have picked up the challenge and certainly are building the ability now to also train in a proper way our foundation grades and general education teachers. Finally, the question from the Honourable Makangwana. A comment I'm sure very welcomed about the Minister. I have to say we're also always pleasantly surprised at the Minister's handling of media briefings, and today was no exception, including in a number of areas where she is not formally in control, issues of skills development and the Department of Labour issues, but we appreciate the comments made there. The question of textbooks is one that is something we're dealing with at the moment. We are recognising that in the absence of a well-qualified, well-prepared teacher, a textbook is an absolutely vital instrument in the hands of every learner. Our commitment last year was that every learner in grade 11, in grade 10, should have at least 7 textbooks on their desk, the 7 subjects that they're following. The truth is that commitment has not been fulfilled. Provinces have not been able to secure it, and regrettably we're still finding schools even at this stage of the year still without textbooks. And it's a concern, Chair, because although the school year is 200 days long, a lot of the scene, as it were, is set in the first couple of weeks. And if learners get there, the books aren't there, there's already a message sent that this isn't really important, and a couple of days here there don't really matter, and we'll soon get started. And it just sends the wrong message from day one that these things can be managed in other ways. Chair, I can tell you that we are giving serious consideration now to the production, not of textbooks, but of learner workbooks, which we ourselves will develop and in fact print. We would aim to make these available to all learners or before even day one, we could ensure that every learner at least has the minimum requirements on their desk to pursue the subject they're doing. It doesn't exclude the use of textbooks to extend and enrich that content, but there is, I can indicate, serious consideration to ourselves taking some steps in that regard. The final point here around the availability of science, I think, and probably other subjects, is also one that I think over time we are giving attention to. It's the notion of curriculum redress and how we ensure that the curriculum offerings in matric, the 29 or so subjects we've agreed on, are offered right across the country, such that, as you say, a learner doesn't then have to leave home and travel far away to a school just to get access to the subjects they want. So that is something that we're giving attention to. I don't know if you want to add anything on that one. But let me hand over to the DDU information.
Thank you. I just wanted to go back to whether there's a new strategy, and clearly we need to deepen and broaden some things that we've been doing. I don't think that we need a new strategy, because the three things that we know from economist studies that teachers, particularly time and textbooks, make a difference, the three T's. Now, I don't think you've heard us say before, as sharply as we are now, talking about time and textbooks, and I think that, if anything, what we're going to do is we're going to be doing a survey of textbooks, and we're going to be insisting that our district officials monitor schools and the time spent teaching, get out a massive campaign on that. So I don't think it's so much new as deepening and broadening. In terms of teachers, teachers' content knowledge is a long-term, medium and long-term strategy, and we've started that with our teacher framework. But something that we've done to try to give teachers greater guidance is that we've developed what we call a 40-week work schedule. So every teacher that you visit should have a 40-week work schedule, and they should be able to show you where they are in the curriculum. In other words, we're looking at pace and coverage of the curriculum. You've told us that when you visit the school that you've seen in kids to exercise books only two or three exercises, even if it's June or October. And what you need to do with us is to start to look at coverage and pace of the curriculum by looking at how many exercises are in the kids' books, and to start to see whether the teacher is keeping pace with her 40-week curriculum. That's what one way that we can look at. And then we've also started to get our exemplars of what the standard should be in grade 1, grade 9, grade 10, 11. Because, you know, up to now we only publish exemplars of the standard when we publish the matric exam. What we start to pull that back is to say this is what a grade 10 exam looks like. This is in grade 1, you should be reading these many words by June of your grade 1 year. So in those two short ways here, we're also trying to support the teachers. That's short-term strategy rather than long-term content knowledge, is to look at pace, coverage, and standards through documents that we've got out to our school.
Thank you, Chair Pearson. I think the department is aware that we congratulate them on the good work that they've done. I just want to find out about this gap between the pulses agenda, which is closing. What could be the reason for that? Is it a decline in the performance of the male, or is it an increase in the performance of the female? Secondly, during our school visits, we have observed that, especially for the underperforming schools, they were involved in an exercise. I think they refer to it as preparing a business plan, something of that sort, where they have to indicate their weaknesses and their strengths. I suppose that information will be used by the department to decide on what interventions to make for such schools. But I just want to know as to what happens from there. I think if we could get that information, it will enable us to monitor and ensure that that information is actually used to the benefit of such schools. And if I may just comment that in the spirit of recognizing excellence and also giving support to those schools that need support, I think it would be a good thing if all schools could at some stage go through that exercise, so that it will enable us to continue to give the necessary support even to those schools that are doing well, to make sure that they remain excellent and even improve, and also to make sure that those schools that need support do get the necessary intervention. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you,
Ambassador.
My question, revolves around the difference in performance between the rural and the urban districts. I would like to attend the official announcement of the result and everything in the first time. You know, the picture was a sad one. The top 10 achievers came predominantly from districts that were urban, but to be specific, from schools that were in the past catered for white people. That's where most of good results came from. And I'm not sure when I look at the results here, but on page 10 also, this sort of confirms what I'm saying. If you look at the number of schools, you don't see, you look at the provinces there, Eastern Cape, Northern Natal, these are predominantly rural provinces. And of course, most schools that are below 50%. Does the department have, now to frame my question, but a forecast, a special forecast or strategy for those schools or something in the rural area, but it seems to be a problem when you look at this plan.
Mine really is around the administration of exams and such, but this is reference to the marking thing. While in some areas, particularly in the area I come from, there is perennially no complaint about the quality of cases. And I have this belief that the certain impact on the morale of the market as such. And you don't want to have angry markets. You know, you would like them to be. So, in fact, I would like to make a request. If this is not done, that some officials or an official be deployed, you know, to do spot check during the market, just to pick up, you know, on, you know, whatever may crop up that would sort of compromise the whole enterprise. You know. Having said that, I also would like to know whether you are so far satisfied with a system of invigilation in place. I would like to have your comment.
That's my dad.
Can I start with this on reason or something? This question, I think some of the members. He says in an informal meeting with tertiary and amateur students in my constituency, he asked a very interesting question, which I was unfortunately unable to answer. I was asked the reason why their exam answer sheets were never sent to the public exam, and the reason why they have to pay for the marking. The other said that in this era of transparency, why there is still some secrets when it comes to the exams. Yes, I know that this is simply
let me, I used to be a member of this committee. Just two general questions which not analyze the outcome. Remember, I made the passing comment on grade 11.
Yeah.
I'm sure we need some update on that. Again, because we are discussing about part of our experiences, I'm worried about the funding of NOFI schools. Let me say again my experience in my province. Where we were sitting at the district with all the EDOs, the report today was that the quantile 2 schools qualify to get their money this year. And in addition to those who got it last year. But their biggest dilemma was that the money is going to be paid in April. It is now January. And according to that act, the schools are not by law allowed to collect any fees.
And the bigger question now, why does the firm choose another arrangement between now and Abraham? Maybe later as a committee we need even need a more briefing on the Northeast School.
Yeah.
One gets a sense the money I get from my province. One got a sense the Northeast School budget that was pushed down by the later minister has not landed. All those good year budgets are 20,000, 24,000, 3,000, when they have 1,260 schools. Kids. And you end up wondering what happened to the money. So I think that will need to be fully fledged so that we get a bigger picture. What has happened to the those schools that were declared last year? Thank you.
There was something in the news that I just wanted to inform you about. Apparently there are some schools, I was always under the impression it's the real poor schools in that certain world that are being declared those in the first and second quartile, so that are declared donkey schools and stuff. But I read about this one school that has a budget of 250,000, I don't know how much, you know, per year or million or whatever it might be. And has now been declared as a donkey school. That came as a shock to the school because they actually had a budget much more than what the department is actually providing them with now. What about those instances and how do you deal with those?
The report I got in mind for the Willowville School, for example, the decision whether you are a Kendall 1 or not, it was a geographic spread. They got started 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 along a given route. You are Kendall 1. Stop, and then they continue.
Chair, thank you. Can I ask Ms. Vinyapol just to lead up with some of the metric issues first?
Chair, if we look at the gender gap, it's the situation is that everybody's improving, the boys and girls, but the girls are improving faster than the boys, so they're getting closer, okay? And the marking, so we do monitor all our marking centres. We have both Omalusi and ourselves monitor, but we will take notes. We did have a bit of a scare in Pumalanga where there was a threat from the markers that they would go slow with the maths marking and we wouldn't have maths results because of the food, but we resolved that problem. But it's an ongoing thing, and every now and then we have a tent of one of the 81 where the food isn't as good as it should be. The invigilation, we train our invigilators every year. So it's an ongoing process of trying to improve the quality. Only Western Cape has members of the community invigilating, all other cases are South teachers. And again, we do random spot checks. My own in the most rural areas of North West, I was really very pleasantly surprised to see how well run it is. There is a secure, safe, and the invigilation goes well. But again, these are processes that we keep up with. Every year we try to improve the integrity of our examination. The remarking is a difficult one, because if we say there's no fee for remarking, everybody will ask for a remark. So what we've done in the last 2 years is reduce it. And if we think that a student has a really solid case and proposes that case and shows us that their internal test mark, the internal assessment mark, we will then consider trying to waive that fee. So, you know, it's again a case of getting access to the point, but we can't at this point take the fee away completely because I think that we would be flooded. So the transparency issue is that it is, you can imagine, if we have 850,000 writing and there's 6 papers of each to get back in the order of 4 million papers, students can still apply to see their paper. They can, in a supervised way, they can for free go and get the paper and have a look at it. So there is that level of transparency. You can't get it back because we keep it for 2 to 3 years in case somebody comes back and wants to look at a remark. Grade 11, approximately 860,000 learners in grade 11 last year. It was always going to be a difficulty point. So in 2005, we wrote into policy the opportunity that if you failed, if you were an older person and you didn't want to proceed on the new curriculum, you would have the opportunity until 2011 to write exams on the old curriculum. And all, as many of us did, those who didn't have the JCs who became teachers, often people who upgraded their qualifications and they had their junior certificate and they already were a teacher, they would do two or three subjects at a time. So we provided that opportunity. But at the same time, the most qualitative, if you want to really give the child a quality education, and they're young, they're 16, 17 or 18, they should stay in school and we should give those schools extra support. So that was our first option, and it's the option we still promote. But there is the option for those who want to leave school, who want to do it part-time, who want to do it through the centres, the distance centres, to still write the senior certificate progressively. And then, of course, with our equity colleges, especially now that they offer their bursaries available, that's the third opportunity. And the fourth opportunity the minister presented this morning is the learnership. So we opened up those four possibilities, knowing that really the young people need very good guidance on what's the best quality so that we don't kind of throw them to the wall. So that's where we are. There were approximately 180,000 grade 11s that failed at the end of 2006. And the provinces are now dealing individually with schools to make sure that nobody is disadvantaged by that. They are advised into continuing their education in whatever form.
Chair, thank you. On some of the other issues, the issue firstly of the underperforming schools, in fact, it's an obligation of every school to develop a school development plan. It's a governing body requirement that they do so. Again, perhaps linking back to the earlier comment I made, many of those school development plans tended to talk about the infrastructure, how we're going to get more classrooms, how we're going to develop the grounds and that sort of thing. And very few of them, to be honest, talked about how we're going to develop the learning outcomes in the school, how we're going to get better quality in the school. And I think, again, that's part of the message we need to look at, and certainly a number of provinces have now indicated that they're becoming much more rigorous in scrutinizing those school development plans and asking of those schools, but what are you doing about improving the results of your school? And if it's not in that development plan, certainly it goes back to them and has to be put in there. So that would not be only for the underperforming schools. It's a requirement that everybody indeed gives attention to that. The question Mr. Mbochani asked about rural-urban differences, it is clearly still a pattern within this country, there's no doubt, and it's not just evidenced in KwaZulu-Natal, it's across the country. We did, of course, have a Ministerial Committee on Rural Education, and we're busy working with the recommendations of that committee. But one of the, I think, conclusions that committee came to was that your small rural schools were neither financially viable or, more importantly, educationally viable. When you had a few learners, one teacher teaching multi-grade, when that teacher has to go to a workshop or for something, some training, there's no one left at the school, those sort of contexts just don't work. It's even more confounding, of course, when you're on private land, the farm school, so-called, where Section 14 agreements really are not being signed by these landowners, etc. And really the committee suggested to us that we need to take quite a different approach. Now I'm pleased to say that a number of provinces have moved in that way. Free State and Northwest, I think, the two most prominent in this regard. Essentially what they're doing is they are amalgamating a number of these very small rural schools and in fact bringing the children into a central place, which is very often a boarding facility. Now, overall, we haven't always been in favour of boarding schools, but one has to say that when you look at and we visited some of these, the context is just so different. That child has his or her own bed, they have their own desk where they do their work at, they get three meals a day, they get supervised homework, all of those kind of circumstances come into play in that situation, and most of them are running on a Monday to Friday, so it's not as if you're taking them away from the family, they're still back with the family, etc. But what they found is that both on a financial level, it's cost efficient, in fact, to rather provide the transport for those learners to get into the nearest town or city where they can attend that boarding school, and I have no doubt that education is going to be beneficial to the learners. So in a way, that's what we're going to look at now. It clearly can't happen. There are many rural schools who are going to be rural schools forever, and we need to look at them, but one of the questions is, what is a minimum size under which you simply lose all the real gains that should come from as it were, getting a school? So perhaps we have to engage with you further on that one in many ways. Chair, the issue of the no-fee schools is one that is concerning us, and I'm a bit cautious. I was going to comment on a statement by a member of the opposition in this committee about some comment regarding the schools awaiting their allocation from the National Department of Education. Now, the Department of Education does not allocate money to provincial departments. You would know there's a separate funding flow. I'm a bit concerned that the chair is now using exactly the same words, in awaiting allocation from the national department. Our department...
...that are saying the national department gets five.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, no, that's
right.
That's right, but he provided that money to provincial treasuries, yes, chair, who would be, so thank you for that understanding and his confirmation. What we've picked up is that many schools are indeed in the position you described, which is essentially one of cash flow. They will certainly get money in April, and I have no doubt in virtually every case, this will be far, far more than they've ever been able to raise in fees. So overall, there's no question they will have their funding and they will be able to not just manage the year, but manage it better than before. But what we've had to do, Chair, is we've given instructions to every province that they should release at least a, we call it a petty cash amount, call it that if need be, to schools at this stage. You see, the provinces are saying we can't allocate to schools yet because until we've got the results of the 10-state survey, we don't know how many learners the school has got, so therefore we don't know what the allocation is that we're getting. So we said to them, don't worry about all that, work on last year's figures, whatever it is, give the school an allocation. Later on you can work out the sums and reconcile if they're going to get more or less or whatever. I am aware certainly that Mpumalanga has indeed made an allocation to all schools at this stage. It's an advance, as it were, on their bigger allocation. And we would be looking to other provinces to do likewise. Every school needs to have, as you say, particularly at the start of the year, ready cash, petty cash on hand to get the year going. Chair, it might have been a bit of a problem. Obviously, this is the first year we've had this in a formal context. And of course, once they get their money this April, that money would be expected to take them through to the following April. It's a one-year allocation. So they will have to also manage their funds in that way. So it's a little blockage here. I can indicate that the Minister of Finance has also picked up on this concern, and he did indicate to us that if we really pick it up that there is really a funding problem in this one, we should approach him and see whether some other consideration could be made to ensure this happens. I think it's a very important element, Chair, because the one thing we want to be clear is that these no-fee schools should indeed be schools of choice and not some deprived, disadvantaged school, etc. So we would be looking to that. As to the issue of the declaration of the schools, I'm very concerned of what you're saying in Eastern Cape, that they were just driving on the road and said, clearly not the way it was supposed to work. It's quite clear what we said is that all quintile 1 and 2 schools should be included, so that is literally 40% of the schools across the country. As to how those schools are declared quintile 1 or 2, there is a very clear indication around how that is supposed to work. But in the end, we give the province discretion to move those schools. So if it's quite clear that on the formula, a school lands up in quintile 3, but you can see all the evidence shows you that the school is accommodating poorer learners, that it is unable to charge fees, etc., the province has absolute discretion to move that school down to perhaps a quintile 2, but of course recognizing that every time you do that, someone else has to move up to quintile 3. And it's a strange thing, of course, but schools are now competing to be poorer than the other because they get more money from the state. But that's really how it should work, Chair. So all I can say is that there are these anomalies. If you are aware of individual schools who clearly have been put in the wrong category, really do let us know, and we will at least take it up with the province and try and get an explanation. But one final point, Chair, is that before a school is declared a no-fee school, the province is obliged to consult with the school. Doesn't mean they have to get the agreement of the school, they must consult. So this circumstance you're talking about, having a groundwork where there's a school with lots of money that for some reason has been declared no-fee, I'm not sure where the consultations were held or what the nature was, but it does seem an anomaly, and it's one that we want to address. But overall, Chair, the system of no-fee schools, I do believe, is a valuable one. We've had direction from the President now that we should indeed be expanding the number of no-fee schools, and we will certainly be doing our sums this year to see what we can do in the years to come. Thanks very much.
I was surprised in the Western Cape. They don't know what they're talking about when they talk quintiles. That one, how was that right? The Western case, we asked the NGO to use what creatures. No, we don't know that. We're using a different formula. I don't know. That's what we found, that where were they also? Remember, we did pull it also.
Yeah.
To our surprise, not just single school, not just single official, in what you're talking about when you're talking creatures. But anyway,
Chair, I would suggest you summon the head of the Department of Western Coast to come to explain. I can't believe there's any school, because schools take this very seriously. You know, the quintile you're in determines how much money you're going to get. I would be very surprised if there's a school who isn't able to tell you up front, I'm in quintile zone. This kid is out of words. Okay. A face.
Why don't I check? I am assuming that we don't need to specify that we ask questions until 1. Some of us are going to go for prayers at 1. Number of you invited to go for. Yes.
How far do you select to the class? But how do you engage the universities? I came with a case where a teacher who last employed the temporary teacher was very troublesome and problematic. The teacher, he got a circular from the district, all temporary teachers must be re-employed. Then the teacher wanted to look at them and said, no, this one is very troublesome. She doesn't come to school, she's professional. Then the teacher says, you dare not re-employ that one, otherwise you'll be in trouble with the union.
Chair, it's hard to respond to sort of general statements like that, but I have to say I think the dynamic is shifting. Certainly at the matric results, you would have seen Sotu smiling very proudly, because the one instance they have of a school here in Khayelitsha that was down in the 20%, I think, and last year produced 94%, I think, pass rate. They're very proud to tell you that the principal of that school is not just a SATU member, but in fact a SATU official in the province. And I think it's starting to change their perception of this. And in fact, SATU is one of the organizations that said, we want to adopt the underperforming schools. So I think that kind of situation, where it might pertain on a local level, if you were to engage any union official at any other level and say, is this acceptable, they will publicly declare, not acceptable, we don't tolerate that behavior. So again, we'd have to say, if there is evidence like that, please do let us know. We will certainly take it up directly. Right. Thanks so much.
Can the department therefore please inform the that list of the first schools? Nowadays, that list, some in our constituencies and districts and rackets, you know, somewhere in that too.
Poorly performing schools, not poor.
Thank you.